I think that judges are, I mean, I have a lot of fun bashing judges, and I like to malign them, and I call them curious, and you know, and I think that we do have to watch out for kissing the whip. I think we do have to watch out for judges who are going to say, bluster, 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 rhubarb, rhubarb, woof, 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 this is my courtroom, you do it my way. I think we've got to stand up to that. I don't think that we can kowtow to that. But by the same token, and I mentioned this to someone on a break earlier, I did a lecture tour in Illinois last winter where I went to 14 cities. And in each city, we did a presentation on persuasion, and a local judge shared the podium to talk about his observations about trial persuasion and trial tactics. And it was really fascinating because, to a person, the not one of the judges disagreed with me in terms of what I was asking the lawyers in the group to do with the jury. Not to the jury, with the jury. You know, they all thought that it would be a nifty idea if a story was told that was compelling, that made sense out of the events. They all thought it was a nifty idea if lawyers would refrain from using legal ritual and legal jargon and relate to the jury. They thought, especially thought, that it would be neat if the lawyers paid attention to what was going on with the jury. One judge told a story of during a voir dire panel. He said, you could hear the people kicking the rail, going, oh God, no, you know, said, oh, we're not getting that question again, you know. And the lawyers proceeded with question after question, and you could see the, he said, you could see the jury members, the prospective jury members, rolling their eyes, going, oh no, not this one again. And the guy just kept right on going. The case that he talked about was a case in which alcoholism was involved. And this lawyer, I don't know the whole context, but this lawyer asked this question. If you found out that my client drank a six-pack of beer every day from the time he was 19 years old, you wouldn't consider him an alcoholic, would you? And he asked that question like a zillion times. And finally, one woman said, yes, I would have a big problem with this. This really means to me that the guy is an alcoholic, and I would have a great deal of difficulty with the fact that he drank that much beer. And the lawyer said, thank you very much. If you found out that my client, you know, he paid absolutely no attention to the answer and went on. You know, wake up and smell the coffee, folks. I think judges would be delighted if lawyers paid attention to the dynamic that was going on, and if they were able to compel, be compelling in the story that they were telling to the jury. You know, I think the things that we've got to watch out for with judges is when they play with us, when they start messing with the Bill of Rights, you know, when they start doing that stuff, you've got to stand up, you know, and you've got to, if you can't do it on your own and you're afraid to do it on your own, you've got to make it a bar issue. When they want to take voir dire away from you've got to go to the Bar Association and you've got to say, I have the right to ask these questions. Let me do it. When they try to interfere with your effective counsel in any way, you've got to stand up because it's really the people's court. It's not the judge's court. You know, I watch people come into court and I want to, you know, take the defendant over on the side or the plaintiff or the Joe layperson and say, hey, this is your court, not his. You'll be fine. You know, this is your court. I mean, judges forget that. You know, they get their golf putter going in chambers and they suddenly think that they've got a lease on the place. And we've got to remind them every once in a while that this is not theirs, that it's the people's. You know, and that's where I think we got to deal with judges. But basically, I think judges are up for persuasion. They're up for interesting trials. They're up for somebody who brainstorms the case and comes up with a new twist on a leg off, you know? And I think they're tired of defense lawyers who don't take a position, who just sort of sit back and poach and poke holes and wait for inconsistencies to come up and then argue, you know? In a recent case that I worked on in Chicago against the CTA, a young man lost his arm And we were able to convince the jury that he lost his arm to the tune of $8 million. And the defense for the Chicago Transit Authority offered no theory. They offered no explanation of how the accident could have happened in a way that's consistent with their lack of negligence. You know, all they said, and it's the defense position, is he was on the tracks, we have no liability. Boom. You know, we jammed on him. You know, we had some nice, nifty things that said, you know, if the train weighs this much and it's going this fast, it should stop in this many feet. And if it were going within the speed limit, it should have stopped here, but it stopped here. Guess who got hit? That's speeding. Boom. And that was sort of incontrovertible. And they went with it, you know. Now, again, I'm talking about this case like it was mine. The lawyer who tried the case was a terrific trial lawyer, and he was able to get up and be charming and compelling and tell a wonderful story about the young man who had suffered this injury. And he told a great story about his life, and he was just terrific. I mean, if I work on an opening statement and I think I've got it, it's the lawyer who stands on his feet and meets the objections when they come up in opening statement. No. Objection, Your Honor, he's arguing his case. Your Honor, I'm entitled to boom, 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 whatever happens. You know, and it's the lawyer's sense of here's my image of the lawyer. And I'm sure you'll identify with it. When I was a kid, I watched the Ed Sullivan Show a lot. You know, I'm dating myself, but we all grew up in the 50s back east on Ed Sullivan. And it seemed like every other week there was an acrobatic act on Ed Sullivan, you know, whether it was balancing seals or whatever. And there was one act that he had on all the time, which I used to be fascinated by, and it was the plate spinner. He would have these long poles that were attached to a table, and he would get the pole going and spin a plate on it, and he'd move down the line, and then move down the line, and he'd have like, whoa, I better get back to this plate, you know, and he'd be doing this back and forth. And that's what I think it's like to be at trial. You got all of these damn plates spinning, and you're running back and forth. You go, get this one going, and you're keeping all of those balls going at the same time, all of those plates spinning at the same time. It's wonderfully exciting. And you know it is. You got this working, you got that working, and the synapses are happening a mile a minute. You're having impact, you're shaping something, you're moving it forward, and that's exhilarating. You know, and the lawyer who can do that and like doing it is a lawyer who looks like he's comfortable trying a case. I know I said he there. I should say the person who looks comfortable trying a case, because I've seen some dynamite female plate spinners recently that have really just looked so at home with trials and trying a case and telling stories. The jury-centered courtroom is a term that I share with several of your colleagues and my friends who are excellent criminal defense lawyers, most notably Steve Wrench in Colorado. He's written a little book called The Wrench Book on Trial Procedure for Criminal Lawyers. He's an excellent, excellent lawyer. And when he and I get to lecture together, it's like we're perfect foils for each other. Steve has the demeanor of a preacher, always wears a blue suit, carries a big heavy briefcase, and has a rather sonorous voice. And when he and I get to working on it, and we support each other in this notion that what goes on in the courtroom must be done for the benefit of the jury, not for the judge or the other lawyers. We really make the point, him from a very lawyery, legal point of view, and me from a more emotional, Italianate point of view, if you will. The jury-centered courtroom is governed by this fact, or this statement, this question, if you will. How is what I'm doing right now going to make this clearer for the jury? And it seems to me that when you address that question, you answer a whole bunch of other questions, even admissibility in evidentiary matters. You know, if you can make a case for how it's going to make things clearer for the jury, then you probably have an argument for why it should be admitted into evidence. You may get thwarted. You may get ruled against, but at least you've thought about getting that piece of material in to make things clearer for the jury. You know, the jury-centered courtroom is one where you put yourself in the jury box and watch everything that's going on. Now, we've alluded a couple of times today to the fact that nothing escapes the jury's notice with regard to attorneys and their dress, et cetera, et cetera. It goes much further than that. The juries watch your relationship with everyone else in the courtroom. You have to think in terms of your primary, from my point of view, your primary relationship is with the jury. Your secondary relationship is with the judge. And then there are all of those other people. There's the court reporter, there's the court clerk, there's the bailiff, there's the witnesses, there's opposing counsel. And you have to be congruent. You have to be the same person in each of those relationships. You can't lean on the jury rail in your best oily voice, you know, and say, trust me, 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 and then turn around and say, what are you talking about? You know, do a Jekyll and Hyde. The jury has to see you as consistent in all of those relationships. There's a rock and roll group called The Police, or there used to be a rock and roll group called The Police, and they had a song, the lyric of which went something like, every move you make, every deal you break, every smile you fake, I'll be watching you. Think about your jury thinking that way. You know, the way you interact with people in the courtroom. Just think about it. Most judges do not like when their courtroom personnel is treated shabbily by lawyers. And lawyers are notorious for treating courtroom personnel in a shabby way. I've seen lawyers in Cook County wait 3 hours for a file that the clerk had right next to her desk because when that lawyer came in the morning, he or she was officious in some way and let it be known that they did not like the fact that this $12,000 a year clerk was going to hold up their schedule. And the clerk says, oh yeah, I'll call you when it's ready. And you end up waiting. And the judge hears only the clerk's side of it when they're on their way in and out of chambers or in court in the morning before you get there. And then the next thing you know, you've got this judge breathing down your neck because you're officious in some way. So even though clerks make too much money, and even though they don't earn the money that they do make, and they are feather bedders, you know, give that person their professional due. Let them know that you depend on them and that they have a certain amount of responsibility for making the system work, and treat them with a certain amount of respect so that they feel like relating to you. You know, how about the court reporter? We tend to treat the court reporter like it's an ear with fingers, when the court reporter really is a person who's pretty overwhelmed. You know, they do this all day long. They go and they type up transcripts all night long, and they do word processing, and they try, you know. You've got an expert coming on the stand, and you're going to get into a whole bunch of technical terms. What would be so horrible about typing up or printing up a list of the terms and their correct spellings? And then when you go into court that morning, show it to opposing counsel, don't violate anybody's, you know, go up to the court reporter and say, Dr. So-and-so is going to be testifying today. These are some of the terms that we think will come out. Here's how you spell them. What a nice guy you are, you know? Then when you want that page of testimony over the lunch break, that court reporter might feel a little bit more disposed towards getting it for you. I know a lawyer in Kentucky who's a little bit berserk right now because they're putting in video cameras in the courtrooms, and he has a wonderful rapport with the court reporter, in where he's able to say, keep an eye on me during this cross-examination, and if there's a part of that testimony that I'm going to want to prepare, or this direct that I'm going to need to prepare my cross or whatever, I'll give you a high sign, you know, sort of like the sting. I'll let you know that that's the section I'm going to be interested in, you know. So he has this little rapport going, and she looks up at him, and he goes, and she picks up her pencil, and she makes a check mark in the margin of her tape. And then when he says, could you get me that section where he talked about the Persevisceris rock or whatever, she says, absolutely, I know right where it is. And she gets it, you know, as opposed to going up to her at 5 o'clock and saying, 10 o'clock this morning when that doctor was talking, can you fish me out that stuff he was saying about, yeah, see you later, chum. You know, and just letting that person know that you rely on them and that you're, you know, that's a nice rapport. The jury sees you in that relationship, you know. The bailiff, I think the bailiff is an incredibly important individual. There was a TV series on a while ago called Crime Story. And I was hired to play the bailiff in the courtroom in one of the episodes. And the reason that they hired me to do it instead, an actor to do it instead of an extra, was they wanted this guy to be busy in the background, you know, making himself look like a bailiff. And I was sitting over at this bailiff's table, and there's a stack of Field and Stream magazines, and there's a stack of Chicago Tribune crossword puzzles all banded together. And I'm sitting there saying, well, I know what this guy does during trial, you know, and they want me to make him look like he's a part of the trial. The most important thing about the bailiff, from my point of view, is that in a long trial, he's the one who has the most contact with the jury. Now, you can't go over to him and say, hey, Chuck, how's it going down with the jury? You know, but you can go over to him and you can say, how'd a bass biting? Did you get out to the lake this weekend? You know, and blah, 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 blah. And you get this rapport going. And then you're going to start hearing stuff like, boy, they didn't like that doctor yesterday. You know, man, they hated that son of a bitch, you know. And you know, and when you've got to rehabilitate him before you go and put any weight, you know, so when you stand up in final argument, you got to re-credential him or something to get him back on the good side of the jury or to get his testimony in a place where they can listen to it. You know, a friend of mine is a personal injury lawyer doing a case involving a woman who missed a step. Okay, she's coming out of a, I forget what it was, a movie theater or a library or something, and the rug on the floor was the same color as the rug a step down, and there was no yellow break point, not unlike this right here, and she didn't see the step, and she stepped down and fell, injured her neck, paralysis in one arm, you know, really got screwed up as a result of it. This is the case. The case is on trial for 4 days or 5 days, and the issue in the case is tripping over a step. This lawyer, being a very moxie guy, without even planning it, without even thinking about it, got gold out of the bailiff. You know, every morning he'd come in and talk to him, hey, Chuck, how's it going? Your kid playing football this year? Great, terrific. And say hi to the missus, right? And they're talking every once in a while. Hardly anything ever about the case, because that's not ethical, right? The jury is leaving to decide the case, and there is a step from the jury box to the floor. And he's standing there saying, watch your step. Don't trip. Watch your step. Don't trip. Gold from the bailiff. You know, gold from the bailiff. You've got to think about those kinds of relationships and how they help you communicate on every level in the courtroom. You know, you've got to think about your relationship to the witness and how you want it perceived by the jury. A lot of times, you know, I've said before, I do a lot of work with criminal defense lawyers. You've got a defendant who is a scuzz bucket, you know, who is dirty, who is not a nice person. And your sensibilities say, I don't want to have nothing to do with this guy or gal, you know. And you inadvertently start to relate to the other people in the courtroom other than your guy. You even start relating more to opposing counsel because your colleagues and your friends, and you're subconsciously saying, I don't want to be associated with this dirtball. And the jury picks up on that. And you have to make, so I'm not saying take a criminal to lunch, please. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that when you're in the courtroom, you have to think about how you want the jury to perceive your relationship to that person. And you need to structure it in a certain way. Yes, sir.
An expert witness, and I've heard two different arguments. One, which is that the plaintiff's counsel, and you got an expert witness, which you shouldn't be seen with them out in the hall and all that kind of stuff. Or on the other hand, I've heard people say, well, no, you should always show that you got a tight rapport with these people. I mean, what's your view on that, Ernst?
The question is, if you have an expert, should you allow the jury to see you being chummy, or should you maintain a professional difference? Every trial has a tenor. Every trial has an atmosphere. Every trial has a tone. And if the given the tone of the trial, if it looks feasible for you to be talking to that expert, then yes. But if we're doing a trial about, you know, nuclear fission, which how much do you know about it? What I know about it could just about wet the bottom of this glass. It's not likely that I would be talking to that guy. So if I'm putting on a show to make it look like, hey, we know something about fission, don't we? The jury is going to see that, and it's going to look put on. I think that probably the safest route to take is to develop a professional rapport. You're here, you're on my turf, we're doing my thing. Watch me take my lead. This is what, good morning, doctor, how are you today? Fine, it's good to see you, thank you. You know, and you just keep it clean. Don't get palsy-wowsy one way or the other. By the same token, I think that you can afford to not deal with their expert. You know this guy is the hired gun. You know that he's done this 20,000 times. You know that he gets paid $700 to $1,000 a day for coming to court and saying what it is he's got to say. And you know that about him. So you might decide to stay away and not let them see you being collegial in a certain way. I think that you, when you're at trial, you control those relationships, you know, and you want to be friendly to your expert, but professionally distant. Because his credibility will go down the tube if it looks like you two are going to go out and have a Michelob later, you know. And their expert, you don't want to look like you're jumping at with a hatchet, but by the same token, you don't want to buddy up to him to make it look like you're trying to manipulate something out of him. Yes, sir. About 10 years ago, along around the same time, people gave that comment about the defense, you know, defense counsel should be at the end of the jury box. Somebody said something about personalizing your client. So what we have is a lot of lawyers standing up and saying, my name is Joe Guastafaro, and I represent Chuck. And, you know, and that's personalizing. You know, they do that. I touched him, you know. If you're going to touch him, make sure you touch him. And make sure you touch him more than once. And make sure you lean over and say something to him. Even if you're saying, don't pick your nose while they're looking at it. You know, make sure that that touch is real. And it's not just some, you know, if you're going to touch somebody, make sure you touch them with the palm of your hand. When you touch somebody with your fingers, you know, if you get your palm on them, it's much warmer and it's much more convincing that you want to touch them. You know, I think that talking to your defendant is real important to set up that personalizing. And you don't have to say anything profound, you know. While the opposing counsel is doing their fumbling, looking for the, where's that post-it we put on page 37? You might lean over and say something like, how's it going? Don't look at your shoes. Come on, look at the jury. You know, you might just do that. And if the jury sees you doing those little things, they'll see that you care about your client. You know, when it's appropriate to touch them, do. But don't make it a touchy-feely exercise. You know, I mentioned on a break an incident in Cook County where a woman defending a huge black guy, about 6'7" and big, you know, tiny in the neighborhood, was accused of raping this woman. And during final argument, this attorney looked at the marshal and said, I'm going to move him out of that chair now, okay? And she got him up and brought him on his feet into the courtroom and said, would you grab me the way she said you grabbed her? And the jury got to see the big guy grab her. He said, well, she said I went like this, but what happened was I went like this, you know? And they saw this woman getting handled by the defendant. Man, did it diffuse the fact that he was a rapist. Man, did it diffuse the threat of this gigantic man. Man, did it diffuse the racial issue of a black-on-white rape. Because here was this defense attorney allowing herself to be touched. Boy, was it a good move. And it made all of this sense on a lot of levels. But it was totally appropriate in terms of the argument. It was absolutely supported in terms of the theory for the defense that they were using. It wasn't a gratuitous, let's touch the defendant kind of move, because that sticks out as well. Okay? The way you relate to your witness during the trial, when you've got a scum bucket, you know, or you've got somebody who's not so nice, and you've got one of those cases where it seems that every 2 minutes you're jumping up for a sidebar about something, make certain that that person has something to do. Here's a guy accused of a triple homicide axe murder. He just chopped up a bunch of people, and you've got to defend him. And you go up to the bench to argue something, and there's 12 people looking at him. Wonder what it's like to be one of those guys. And he's sitting there saying, oh my God, I don't stand a chance in hell of them ever finding me innocent. And you give him something to do. I've gone as far as taking a spiral-bound notebook, cutting out pages of a comic book, and gluing it into the notebook. So every time I go up there, I want you to read this, but don't let anybody see what you're reading. You know? So the guy takes out his book and he starts doing the Phantom meets Tarzan or whatever, you know, but he's doing something. Write a letter to your mom. You know, have that person do something instead of sitting there staring at the jury, because they're bound to get nervous. Yes, sir.
That's the one thing that I'm surprised coming here in the directorial field. That is the way you dress the fellow, the way he sits, the way he put him in a vest and a dark blue suit, and he doesn't look like a hatch plant. He looks like an accountant.
Absolutely. The way you dress the defendant, the way you dress your client, if that becomes an issue in the particular case you're working on. And it's not only with people who are reprobates. They're not only with the criminal defendant, you know. You've got a doctor on the stand. He's a surgeon. It's a malpractice case. Have him get a manicure. You know, you don't want a doctor to have dirty fingernails. Little things like that. Sure, think about it. You know, the guy's heavy. Let him buy a suit the next size up so that it doesn't look like he's busting out of his clothing with prosperity, you know. think about how you want that to look. It's absolutely all a part of it, you know. It diffuses a great deal. Yes, sir.
I put it in a picture and it just looked random. I'm like, I know his finger under his collar and it just doesn't look natural. What about just having him dress in the deep clothing, but not the damn suit, something that he feels comfortable going back to the point.
Sure. I think that that's real appropriate. A friend of mine in Cook County was trying a death penalty case, and there was the defendant looked like a monster. I mean, he was gigantic and a big bull neck, you know, and he was insane. I mean, you could look at this guy and say, he's nuts. You know, he was just staring at people from down under here. And he was a real asocial individual who you did not have to be a therapist to say that man needs help, not imprisonment. I mean, this guy was a total asocial, sociopathic dude. To put him into a suit would have been nuts. So we got him, you know, a nice knit shirt, you know, that he sort of felt comfortable in and sort of hung on him nice. And he, I mean, there was no way you were going to make this guy look good, but you made him look less than threatening, you know? And he, I mean, he was really, he was a frightening person to look at. He was scary. And the jury is going to get scared. So anything you could do to make him feel comfortable so that he doesn't feel like he needs to be scary, which is pretty much his psychology for how he grew up. People don't like me. I better scare them before they get to me. You know, and just diffuse that by trying to make him feel as much as comfortable. But, I mean, even an idiot knows that he's on trial for his life, and he's bound to be nervous, and he's bound to be scared. So you've got to do something to put that person at whatever ease you can. And if dress helps, dress helps. Sir. Well, I don't know how it works here in Texas, but in Illinois, we have two configurations to the courtroom, and there's not a whole lot we can do about it. One configuration is that if this is the judge's bench and the witness box is here, the jury panel is here, counsel tables are this way. Okay, now this is not to scale or anything. Another configuration, actually there are three. Another configuration is where the counsel tables go this way. And the third configuration, which baffles me, I have no idea why it ever came to be, is that the defense, the counsel tables go this, sorry, this way. And the state usually sits here and the defense usually sits here. Depending upon your configuration, depending upon the presentability of your defendant, depending upon your client, depending upon, you know, I would try to neutralize it as much as possible. If it's not such a bad crime case, if he's not such a heinous individual, you might sit him at the end of counsel table that's closest to the jury so they get to see him. It might be another kind of case where he's not the kind of person that you want to put there because he has a tendency to growl every time he sees a police officer. You might want to put him a little further away from the jury box, you know? Yes, sir. To get the question? if you feel like you've got a football field to overcome in order to reach the jury and the plaintiff, and the plaintiff and his attorney are closer to the jury than you are. If you really think that it's an impediment, you might bring it up pre-trial to the judge and say, can we change the configuration of the tables? He'll probably say no, but you've at least let him know that you're concerned about this, and you start the small education process. The other thing that you can do to overcome that football field, you know, is make up as much yardage as you can every time you can. Get out of your chair. If you're in the situation where you're confined to a chair, you've got to strategize about a sheaf. I don't use that word very often, but it's a neat word. A sheaf of documents that are going to get you out of your chair, moving towards the bench, moving towards the witness, moving towards the clerk, moving towards opposing counsel, so that you can get up and be animated in that space and close the distance rather than hanging back there and lobbing it in or phoning it in. No. While we're talking about this concept of distance, think about pieces of demonstrative evidence. You know, I watched the trial in upstate New York that was, I mean, I just love the lawyer for doing it, because he put up this big graph, this big chart showing something about wage losses and this attempted fraud based on wage losses. And he had it all graphed out neatly. And he positioned it in the courtroom that was in a perfect position for the jury. But the judge couldn't see it very clearly. And the judge kept saying, counsel, can you move that so I can see it, please? And the lawyer, knowing that the jury was the most important part of it, said, certainly, Your Honor. How's that? You know, and they did that dance about four times before the judge gave up. You know, before the judge said, yeah, okay, let's get on with it. You know, but it was like, let me see it, to hell with the jury. And the lawyer was saying, no, judge, it's the other way around. The jury has got to see it. How's that, Your Honor? Is that okay? Great. You know, and just making sure that he was responding to the judge's request, but not giving up any ground in terms of the chart being visible to the jury, the trier of fact, the most important person. You know, the judge is nosy. He wants to see it because he wants to know what's going on. Well, terrific. Come in early or stay late, chum. Let's make sure that the jury sees it at the moment they need to see it in order to advance my argument. How is what I'm doing right now going to make it clearer for the jury? You know, similarly with pieces of physical evidence, you know, that you are now going to publish to the jury. I love that. You know, can we publish this to the jury? Terminology, ritualistic terminology. You know, you've got documents or whatever that you're going to hand to them, and they're going to circulate around. There's that incredible moment where you're saying, do I go on with this while they're looking at that? Or do I wait? And if I wait, he's going to say, let's go, counsel. We're wasting the court's time. And you know that anything you say is going to go right out the window while they're looking at whatever it is that's being handed around. Try to strategize about it and not hand it around until you're done. You know, and then when you're done, you get it to the jury and you go sit down, and the other guy gets up and they got it. And he gets caught in the, you know, you've got to work that out so that they're not being absorbed in the physical evidence while you're trying to make other points. And you've got to have a couple of stock things in your pocket so that when he says, woof, 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 let's get on with it, you know, something real oily, like, you know, Your Honor, the jury would be best served if we waited for more testimony until the evidence was viewed, or, you know, something to make him get off your back about time. If you know it's going to happen that way. I think the best thing to do is to make them so excited about the piece of physical evidence and then not let them get their hands on it until they go back into the deliberation room. Then when they get back there, it's going to be, let me see it, you know. And that's great, because their interest their interest is really high at that point. Yes, sir.
On that point, I had a friend who was dealing with a bowling lawyer who, I was meeting him on all these cases, but every time he would go to the judge, he would say, "Thank you, Your Honor." And the jury thought he was thinking, you know, they would rule over him.
What do you do, right? You're beating the guy on objections, and every time the judge rules, he says thank you, whether he won or lost. I don't know. You know, I mean, just keep on going. I've heard judges say when counsel says thank you, Your Honor. I've heard judges say don't thank me for doing my job. You know, because they don't like to be put in that position of the jury perceiving them to be totally on one side. So I've heard that, don't thank me for doing my job, counsel, when people have used that ploy. I think that when you make an objection and you win, you know, I think that's time for the cross pen to come out and the check to go down on the pad so that they know you've won something. Similarly, when you get sustained, you know, and you're taking it in the chops, you can't allow the jury to see you whimper. You know, I don't know that you want to go as far as to say thank you and carry on like nothing happened. But I think that you have to, as I said to someone earlier, there comes a point in every trial where you must pass what is called the hot poker up the nose test. You know, you're getting it and you can't let them know it hurts that you're getting it, and you've just got to stand there. You know, that happens, and there's, I think it's okay to be justifiably indignant when you're getting clobbered and let the jury know that you're being treated unfairly without becoming a whiner, without becoming a judge, he's doing that again kind of. I think that you've got to, there's a good rule of thumb. The attorney should never let his indignation be greater than the jury's indignation. And when you've been objected to three times in a row now, and you know that there's no grounds for the objection, and all he's trying to do is disrupt your flow, and what you want to turn around and do is bite his head off, you know, you have to make sure that you have to sense that the jury knows he's doing it to be obstreperous. He's doing it to be a burr under your saddle. He's doing it to be a pain in the patoot. And once they're sure of that, you can turn on them, you know, and then they'll say, yeah, he deserved it, you know. But if you do it right off the bat, they're going to say, whoa, what's he so riled about? Short fuse, that guy, hasn't he? And they're going to start holding that against you. Never let your indignation get ahead of theirs. And they will pick up on it. They will know when somebody is messing with you for fun. You know? And judges usually give it away too, the way they rule. What is it, counsel? You know, you have another objection? You know, they let that tone of voice happen. You know, the case that I was just working on, the judge would say, this prosecutor was an example in bad trial technique. I mean, he did not know how to ask a question. And we would object to leading questions on direct and stuff. And Mike would say, I object, Your Honor. And the judge would say, I bet you do. You know, and it, just little things like that would come out. And it was like, great, we love it. You know, that. But they let you know the judge's inflection and tone and that sort of thing. I don't know why the prosecutor didn't say something about that. May I approach the bench, Your Honor? The way in which you're ruling on these objections is really giving a direction to the jury about how you're thinking about the issue. And I wish, you know, why not? You've got to, you know, think about all of that stuff and let it go on. But remember that to juries, the judge is the most important person that they've ever met in their lives. And we forget about that because we get so used to going in and out of court, and we know that he's dozing up there or thinking about his golf game at 4 o'clock. And we know that he's a guy who puts his trousers on one leg at a time, or he's a gal who's you know, worried about carpool just like the rest of us. He's a gal. Did I say he's a gal? She's a gal. We know that they're people, but the juries tend to think that they are the most powerful. And if you take on the judge, it's going to be held against you. So you've got to make sure that you've really got all your ducks in a row and that you're really on an issue that the jury understands before you go after the judge. I think you should do everything that you possibly can to avoid the jury seeing you as being cantankerous with the judge. Now, sometimes you have to. Yes, sir.
Most juries resent heavy-duty cross-examination of police officers in criminal cases.
Depends on the city. You know, I mean, I don't think there's anybody in Chicago who would side with a cop. I mean, I really don't. I mean, the police are continually in the paper for taking bribes, beating people up, police brutality. Everybody's got the 1968 convention working in their head. I mean, the Chicago police are really in a hole looking up, and they've got some bad credibility problems. But there are other communities where, you know, you get out into the suburbs where all of the policemen look like, you know, they've got the mustache. They look like they've been stamped from a cookie mold. They all have their hair cut a certain length and their regulation mustache, and they say, yes, sir, and they're very polite. And they're all young. I mean, that's how I knew I was getting old, and all of the cops suddenly got younger than me. And these young, good-looking, Adam 12-type officers, you know, they're tough to deal with. I don't know what the cops are like in Texas. I got stopped once by a state trooper in northern Texas in 1968, and I was in an MG with bell bottoms and a ponytail, so I'm a little bit off base in my assessment of how I was treated by that police officer. I think that you have to, the structure of the cross-examination of a police officer has got to be one where you put both of you on the side of the law. We both want to see that the right thing is done. And with, you know, you're going after him to establish his time on the police force, his manner of taking records, his training, his police academy, and you're building him up in a way that makes him acceptable. Then you gradually start to erode him. But you didn't follow that procedure this time. And when you didn't follow that procedure this time, you knew that it was going to be a problem. So when you went back to the records, you erased what you wrote when it happened, right? You know, and you've got to set him up and then gradually erode his credibility. You can't take him on with a shotgun blast. You got to go after him with a laser beam and just remove the part that's rotten so the jury can see it real handily. I think that when we get a bad cop or a bad investigation or a bad expert, you know, we get eyes like saucers. We want to go for the throat immediately, and we forget about the incremental steps of cross-examination and taking them apart one rivet at a time, as long as it takes to get at what you're after. One fact, one response. One fact, one response. And you go at it very, very slowly. The tendency is to say, "You lying sack of a, you know, sitting there with lips blistered of perjury, I'm going to blow you out of the water." You know, you want to go into all of that stuff and do Perry Mason. But, I mean, how many times have you seen the opposing counsel throw in the towel because of one cross-examination question? You know, do we expect that the witness is going to say, "You're right, I did it, forget it"? And, you know, it's not going to happen. So we've got to think about it all happening in very small increments that build towards the overall persuasion. I've never seen a reversal on cross-examination, and I've seen some pretty brilliant cross-examination. People are getting hammered in cross-examination, and they still stick to their story. They're getting riveted, bang, 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 and they still just sit there and say yes or no, but they never say, "You're right, I lied." They never say, "Oh, you're right, I'm full of it." They never do that. They always stick to their story, even though you can prove that they're lying, which is what you do in final argument. You come back, and I think you've got to do that with cops, you know, especially with cops. Two rules. The guy who doesn't deal in absolutes is about to give you two rules. Rule number one, don't move unless you got someplace to go. And rule two, don't speak unless you got something to say. I watch lawyers pace. And I'm a pacer, as you can tell. I like to pace. I think better when I'm pacing than when I'm sitting. I often get up and walk around my study, you know, walk around. I'll be writing something and I'll get up from the keyboard and I'll start walking around doing this. My wife thinks I'm a lunatic. I like to think while I'm walking. But sometimes what happens at trial is that the pacing becomes sort of automatonic, you know, and you got this robot pacing back and forth, and they're into their own world, and they're talking, and they're thinking, and they're just, and they're just walking back and forth. Don't move unless you got someplace to go. And what I would suggest to you is that you think in terms of triangle. This is a little bit of stage blocking from my years of studying to be a director. If the courtroom is set up like so, maybe the court reporter is here, and you've got ladies and gentlemen of the jury over here, and you've got counsel table, right? You're on your feet. To come out here and pace up and down, you're moving parallel to the audience in a very undynamic line that becomes rather boring after a while, you know? So think about giving yourself some places to go. So I'm going to talk and I'm going to pace. I might pace up to here and come down to here and put some angles in that line. I might find a moment to turn my back on you and walk over to this chair and kind of hang out until I've got a point to make, and then come forward in a vertical line so that's more dynamic. So that as you pace around, say this is your chair, you know, you might start out here with your ever-present legal pad, you know, ensconced on the corner of the desk. And you might walk up to the reporter, and you might walk back to the edge of the desk, and you might walk up to here, and then over to the, and then, you know, so that you have some place to go as you're walking and thinking, as opposed to just getting up and pacing up and down in front of the box. Angles are a much more dynamic movement. If you move on diagonals, the line of the movement is more interesting to watch. So if I'm moving this way, it's more interesting than my moving this way. And what we've got to watch out for is that our mind gets going on what we're trying to do with the case, and we forget about this geography, right? And we just get into thinking about what we're doing, and it becomes sort of inadvertent, and there's that word again, inadvertency does us in, and we're pacing back and forth without thinking about the dynamics of the move and how we might move it. The don't speak until you have anything to say is really just an admonition to watch out for the nonverbal fillers that lawyers use as an affectation of thinking. Now, somewhere we were taught that if we keep the motor running, and we do this sort of yes, ahem, yes, ahem, yes, ahem kind of stuff, that people are going to know we're still involved. And you've seen people do that, right? It's sort of a nonsense droning. And when we come to a point where we may momentarily lose our place, or we may momentarily lose our train of thought, instead of saying something like, let me check back here with my notes to see where we're going, or instead of saying, excuse me while I look at this, excuse me for a second, and getting back, we stand there and we go, And we get stuck in that, kind of stuff. And I think that that's real, real detrimental, because people start to focus on the nonverbal fillers that you use mid-thought. Don't be afraid of silence. There can be a pause. You lose your train of thought, and it happens to all of us. Fill the silence with a movement, with a look, and your mind is on scramble. Where the hell was I? Where was I going? You know, and you get back to it instead of getting into some kind of nonsensical patter. And if we go back to that, when we think about, and you start doing this stuff, it doesn't help you get anywhere, and it throws them off. So don't be afraid of the silences. Silences also are very, very, very important about just letting something out there. So you know that you're building up to a point. You know that this question is going to be a real point, a real issue that you want to hang in the jury's mind. So you might think about setting it off with silence. So you ask that question in cross-examination, an officer, when you made out this report, you violated the department procedure. And if you've shown that he's violated department procedure by all the other questions leading up to that, he's going to try and tap dance on a twig. You know, he's going to say, yeah, but, you know, sometimes, well, it depends on the circumstances. And, well, in this case, I thought that it would be better if, and no matter what he says, you've got the mo, you've got the momentum, you've made your point. Best if he says nothing, or you ask a question where there's just emptiness and you let it hang like a nice cloud. And you back off and you don't say a word, and the silence is golden. If nature abhors a vacuum, lawyers abhor silence. They feel like they've got to fill every moment, every instant with some kind of verbal sound. And it's just not true. It's just not true. It's like if you watch a lot of sports, there's a whole school of sports commentators that came to television from radio. And there's a whole school of sports commentators that were brought up on television. Did I say that right? Yeah. The people who came over from radio feel obligated to fill every moment of airtime with sound. We have Harry Carey in Chicago who does the Cubs. He talked so much that his brain is not in gear while his mouth is working. He just keeps talking because back in the old radio days, they had a rule against dead air time. You can't have nothing happening. People will change the channel. You know, if they're not getting anything when they're going through the dial, you better make sure, you know, you got to make sure. And you get somebody else, I can't think of a sports announcer, well, somebody like Frank Gifford, you know, who's a color man, or now he's a play-by-play, but he's a total television announcer, does not feel obligated to talk. So these long periods of time where you're just looking at the screen and you don't hear anything, because he knows that he's working in a visual medium. Lawyers forget that a trial is a visual medium. People have lots of things to see, lots of things to focus on, lots of things to look at, lots of things to do. And if there's a little bit of silence, that's fine. But you must keep it jury-centered. The silence that I hate the most, that's a pretty strong term. I don't know that I really hate anything. But the part that really bothers me the most when I'm at trial is when counsel is in the middle of a line of questioning. They've got the ball rolling. The momentum is going. They're asking questions. Things are moving along. And then all of a sudden, there's a pause. Like, did you? And there's this, like, what does it have to do with anything? If you're going to use a silence, finish the question, finish that unit, get it over with, and then let the silence be there. Overhead projectors. It always happens with overhead projectors because the counsel, the lawyer will be up and he'll be saying, now, ladies and gentlemen, you'll see. Quick. By the exhibits that we put together here, that, you know, it's, there's no coordination between the text and the audiovisual support. And there are these incredible breakups and these incredible, this incredible lack of flow. And what would it take to think about picking up your pad and walking over to the overhead while you're talking and clicking it on? You know, as opposed to, and now, well, here, wait a minute. That kind of herky jerky starting and stopping stuff that happens right in the middle of a direct examination. And I think that you need to really think about how pace and tempo and movement within the testimony is real important for the jury. If you're not varying it, if you're not moving it along or slowing it down and allowing it to sit for a little bit, they become very bored. They become very tired. Everything starts to take on the same weight because it's hit with the same emphasis at the same rate. It's sort of like looking at a picket fence, you know? All of the spaces and all of the slats are the same, you know, and you've got to break it up. And you can break it up with silence, you can break it up with movement, but you've got to have something definite about what you're doing with that movement and with that silence. Another syndrome that I think is real, I don't even have enough papers out here to demonstrate it. It's the what I call the flustered lawyer look. You know, where somebody comes into court with their trial and they're going to put it down, you know, and what they're communicating, what they're saying nonverbally is, oh, I'm so hassled, oh, I'm so busy, oh, woe is me, you know. And I think that they lose ground with the jury when you look this disorganized and when you've got papers coming out of every possible fold that you can think of. No. And when that person, this is the evidence dance that I was talking about earlier, when you leave your feet to get something put into evidence, please know what the heck you're going to do. You see lawyers who start out from counsel table and then two steps across the floor, it's like, should I show this to opposing counsel first? Should I get it marked first? And they're stuck out there in the middle of the floor and they don't quite know what to do. Then they get self-conscious and they get tentative about it. You know, if you have to and you're not sure, make a ground plan of your courtroom. Stick it on a Xerox machine and run off 50 or 60 copies and keep them in a file. Then every time, and if you practice in different courtrooms, make one for each courtroom. And every time you're getting ready to go to trial, you whip out your ground plan of what that courtroom looks like. And you say, one, stand up. Two, go to the clerk, get it marked. Three, go to opposing counsel. Four, take it to the witness stand. Three and a half, ask permission to approach the witness. Isn't that bogus? May I approach the witness, Your Honor? Go there. You know, if this is number four, then that's number four, you know, and know exactly what you're going to do so that you don't get caught out in the middle of the floor saying, is it three? Is it two? Who gets it now? So because that whole sense of moving through the procedure is very persuasive. If you look like you know what you're doing, the jury is going to look to you for information. You're going to become the person that says to them, hey, watch me, I'll tell you what you need to know. And that's very persuasive.
This is the end of tape 5. The program continues to tape 6.